Your year-end gift to WBEZ can power the news you rely on all year long. And when you give today, you can pick up our 2026 Mural and Mosaics calendar as our thank you gift. It features stunning photos by Chicago public media photojournalists and puts the artistry of Chicago on display in your home. Give before December 17th to get it before the new year. Take a look at wbez.org/calendar.
Federal rule changes shift federal policies from a housing first model to a transitional housing model.
The cuts in funding come with more restrictive regulations on how funding can be spent.
We're talking about 8,000 people who now have permanent supportive housing are at risk.
People who are currently experiencing homelessness, those who are currently in shelter or currently outside, no longer have an option for housing.
Hey, Chicago, I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is In the Loop. Stick around for a breakdown of the day's top local news stories later on in the podcast. But first, the federal government just announced a major shakeup to the way that it funds programs that address and prevent homelessness. Now, this could mean thousands of formerly unhoused people across Illinois are now at risk of losing their homes. Joining me now in studio is In the Loop producer Linnea Dominic. She produced this episode. Welcome back, Linnea. Good to see you.
Good to see you, Sasha.
You know, we get our story ideas from multiple different sources, mm-hmm. right? Sometimes it's just things that we've observed as we're moving about life, articles that we'll see covered by different publications. Sometimes listeners call in or write in and tell us about things happening in their neighborhoods. This particular segment comes from a conversation you had with someone pretty close to you.
Yeah, my godfather. He lives in Iowa, and he's been working in homelessness prevention for decades.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and so a couple of weeks ago, he reached out. He's like, hey, is this on your radar? This big change is coming. Politico broke the draft that the Trump administration was working on. So you all should really look at this and cover this. I can send you data for Cook County. Mm-hmm. And I was really grateful that he had flagged it for me because it's such a big deal. And I loved that he was keeping tabs on it from a different state.
Yeah, no, that is awesome. And I'm really glad that we were able to do it because I love the fact that there's that that crossover, yes, from state to state. But I also hate that. I hate mm-hmm. that was an issue here in Illinois and something that folks here have to deal with. And it just really shows the footprint of all these changes that are coming from the White House, mm-hmm. right? It's really sort of touching lives all across the country.
Absolutely.
So we talked in this conversation that you're about to hear about these cuts coming from the federal government that are really impacting folks who have, you know, struggled with homelessness and are potentially going to end up right back on the streets. And so many mixed messages there. You know, there's transphobia and xenophobia also mixed in mm-hmm. to these new policies. Tell us more about that, because this is a piece that we didn't actually get into with our guests.
Yeah, so the administration is now saying that organizations that serve transgender or non-binary clients could lose their funding if they, quote-unquote, recognize their identity.
Wow.
Yeah, so huge. We saw in the campaign for president that Trump and J.D. Vance ran that transphobia was deeply embedded in their messaging,
right,
in their political advertisements. And so this seems like they're really making good on what they promised on the campaign trail to go after members of the trans community. And this is just a really insidious way that they're doing it to withhold funding from organizations that not only recognize identity, but are serving right. people who are experiencing homelessness.
Well, our guests really do get to the core of what this means for thousands and thousands of people living in Illinois. So let's get to that conversation. It's a really important one. Thanks, yeah. Linnea.
Thank you.
At the table, Christine Haley, who is Illinois' chief homelessness officer, and Mark Ishog, who's CEO of Thresholds, which provides services to people with mental illness and substance abuse disorders. So lots happening right now. So many things, one impacting the other. I want to hear just overall your reaction to all of the shifts coming from the federal government and impacting people who are here and recently, you know, surviving homelessness. You first, Christine.
So this weekend, we had a big snow, and mm-hmm. our homes protected us from the snow. We are also just getting off our Thanksgiving holiday, and in my home as I'm housed, I was able to host family from out of town. We were able to share together in our home. And the reality is that we believe that over 7,500 people in Illinois are at risk of losing their permanent housing. And all for a choice to be able to shift away from evidence-based practices. Mm-hmm. We talk about Housing First, and Housing First is both a way in which it's a philosophy, right? Where we think that before all else, we all need housing. It is also an evidence-based practice called permanent supportive housing. Permanent supportive housing is for people who, where the head of the household has a disability, mm-hmm. and who has a long history of homelessness. So at least a year, but for many people, it's multiple years of either living in a shelter or living in a on the street, or a combination of both. So in that, we understand that the current administration, the Trump administration, is moving away from Housing First. We've seen that this was on the horizon,
right,
in a few different ways. Through the president's executive order to fight crime, it talked about moving away from Housing First. It talked about utilizing grants as a way to implement this new piece of really criminalizing homelessness, where we understand very clearly that people experiencing homelessness are our friends, our neighbors, are you and me, mm-hmm. are those of us who really can't afford market rate rent. And that is the true cause of homelessness, is our lack of affordable housing, lack of the income to be able to afford market rate rent.
Right. Mark, Christine talked there about some of the cuts to these federal housing or homelessness programs, as well as that permanent supportive housing that we know is so critical here in Illinois. 8,500 people could be kicked out of their permanent housing across this state. Who will be the most impacted?
Well, it impacts really everybody, especially people of color who are overrepresented among the homeless population in Chicago, the elderly, people with disabilities, including mental illness and substance abuse challenges. So when we're talking about 8,000 people who now have permanent supportive housing, hundreds of whom are Threshold clients and in Threshold housing, mm-hmm. Are at risk. And we are already in a housing and homeless crisis in Chicago. And this policy, if it were to go into effect, takes us from, in my opinion, from crisis to catastrophe. There are thousands of people living on the streets today. As I took a lift to get to the studio this morning, I passed them. Mm-hmm. And knowing that my outreach workers and those from the Knight Ministry and those from the city of Chicago are out there right now trying to help people in this cold weather find shelter and a place to stay. So if we have a problem now, which we do, and a crisis now, we are moving to catastrophe.
So what do you say to people who don't think that federal money should be used to subsidize people's housing?
Well, it's really actually a really good investment because it's relatively affordable. The cost of institutional stays, hospital stays, prison stays, we're talking $100 to $200 to $300 a day. And if you're in a state institution, it could be thousands of dollars a day. Permanent supportive housing with wraparound services costs about $75 a day. I mean, talk about a good investment. So by cutting permanent supportive housing, we're not only creating a humanity crisis, we are really creating an economic crisis in this city. Most of those people in Chicago who are living in permanent supportive housing are doing so with rental vouchers,
yeah.
that allow people to be in the apartment of their choice. And almost all of these, outside of those that are owned by Thresholds and our partner agencies, are mom and pop landlords, small homeowners.
That's right.
Thousands of these men and women who have invested a lot of money in good, affordable, supportive housing are also at risk.
So instead of renewing existing grants, continuum of care grants, they're called for 2026, HUD is essentially forcing this brand new competitive process, even though current grants start expiring in late January. So they're also saying that the impact of what they're doing, like they're not kicking people out of homes, they're just changing the rules a bit. Does that make sense to you, Christine? Is that accurate?
So our understanding is that there is a cap on permanent housing. So currently, our existing grantees, about 90% of the funding through this program goes for permanent housing. And HUD has decided to cap permanent housing at 30%. So therefore, we understand very clearly that there will be a gap of permanent housing resources. The people who currently are living in apartments, who rely on that support, and again, the majority of those are people who are living with disabilities, will lose that subsidy. Mm-hmm. So that is a black and white understanding of what is happening. There right. isn't a difference there.
There are no ifs, ands, or buts about that.
Exactly. I think that the, what the shift is to transitional housing. And HUD has really moved away over the last number of, 20 years away from transitional housing because it does not have positive long-term housing outcomes that permanent housing interventions like rapid rehousing and permanent supportive housing have, mm-hmm. And is really encouraging providers to apply for transitional housing where folks will be able to live for up to 2 years, but where there are mandated services, required services. And for those of us that think about like requirements, I know in receiving healthcare, that really a lot of our healthcare is around a choice. I can get a recommendation from my doctor, but that it's really up to me to want to engage in an intervention for it to work, that forced mandated services do not work.
Is this going to make, you think, homelessness encampments worse?
Absolutely. I believe that there will be an increase to unsheltered homelessness because essentially with this change, right now communities are really struck with how are we able to take all of our existing resources to prevent people from becoming homeless.
Yeah.
So they're doing internal shifts to be able to move folks to that 30% cap. And what that looks like on the ground is that people who are currently experiencing homelessness, those who are currently in shelter or currently outside, no longer have an option for housing because there are no longer referrals being made for housing placements. So I think it's important for listeners to understand that as they see an increase to homelessness. And as they see more people living outside, they mm-hmm. may think, what happened to that person? What bad decision did that person make that now they're living outside in January, in February, when the reality is that this was a choice that was made by the administration to cut funding off, which will result in longer wait times as people go to hospitals
right.
And the cost of that, right? As people may go to emergency rooms for support, many shelters will be full. So I definitely anticipate seeing both an increase in unsheltered homelessness and an increase to what we may see in hospitals as people seek shelter.
I'm glad you also brought up the stigma involved in there, because a lot of people think that way,
yes.
unfortunately. And there's a 2021 study that I want to quote. It's from the University of Chicago, and it found 53% of people in shelters, 40% of unsheltered people, they had jobs. They were employed during the year that they were experiencing homelessness. So, Mark, it sounds like having a job, that's not a guarantee that you won't be homeless.
Yeah. I mean, there's a fabulous new book that came out this year by an author named Brian Goldstone. It's called There Is No Place for Us, Working and Homeless in America. And that's the story of five people in Atlanta, though it could be five families anywhere,
mm-hmm.
Of the 4 million people in this country that are the working poor and the working poor homeless. And he documents in this book sort of the tragedy at both the individual mm-hmm. level and the systems level. But it's never blaming the people that are experiencing homelessness and working their butts off. It's that the system is stacked against them. You know, people don't fall into homelessness in this country. They are forced into homelessness because the rents are too high. The bureaucracies to build new affordable housing are Herculean. We're trying to cut the red tape in Chicago, and so that's a really positive step forward. Mm-hmm. So there's the face of homelessness that everybody sees on the streets, and we'll see more of if these policies go into effect. And then there's the millions of people who are basically living in their cars or couch surfing or living in inappropriate, especially for family conditions.
Right.
So, you know, there's something I want to just talk about. This attack on housing first, this model that Christine referenced, this is completely ideological. This is not based on evidence.
Yeah. So they're shifting away from finding housing before treatment.
But housing first does not mean housing alone. In almost every instance, people who are in housing, in rapid rehousing or in permanent supportive housing, as we call it at Thresholds for thousands of our clients, wraparound services are part of the not-so-secret sauce to success. You know, our tagline is home, health, and hope, and we were purposeful about that because it starts with housing. But it's the healthcare services, the mental health care services, substance abuse treatment, mm-hmm. supported employment, all these wraparound services that keep people in their home. We have 40 years of evidence to show that this model of housing with wraparound services works.
Right.
And all of that is at risk. And that's what the listeners need to understand. I also want to just point out really quickly that this doesn't have to happen. There are two lawsuits pending right now, one brought by 20 attorneys general and a couple of governors from 20 states across the country. And just yesterday, the National Alliance to End Homelessness also entered a lawsuit against this.
I mean, do you think these will be successful?
Well, I mean, this is how we're fighting this administration, both on the ground.
Well, it seems like a universal tool that's available to everyone at this point with all the different changes coming down from the White House.
So trying to fight it through grassroots organizing and telling our story and in the courts, exactly.
Yeah. Christine, your thoughts on that, you know, because Mark brings up an interesting point, and I know that some people listening, they might think that, yes, the mental health or substance abuse treatment requirement, getting that help first before you get housing, that might sound logical.
Mm-hmm. All of us need housing, period, in order to live fruitful lives where we are able to take our medications, be able to get the food that can keep us healthy. And we ultimately believe that housing is a human right. And if we believe that, then there should not be conditions upon which one person is able to live in a home and another person is not. Just as we don't place conditions on food, that one person should have food and another needs to prove that they are worthy to have food. We believe ultimately as our society and food and education and housing should be part of that as well.
How's the Pritzker administration responding to all of this?
So within the Illinois Office to Prevent and End Homelessness, we are working closely with our community agencies to, one, understand, you know, how there is flexibility within our current funding to be able to support these shifts. We meet with our 19 community areas weekly to be able to understand and support them in getting the information that they need at the state level to be able to apply for funding. I think that we understand at this root, though, that homelessness is caused by the increase in rents. And we've seen across our state an increase of fair market rents by over 40% in Illinois. Mm-hmm. We've also seen, though, in the 11 out of our 19 community areas that we have decreased homelessness in our state, right? That here in the Chicago area, homelessness has decreased by 60%, primarily because of new arrivals are no longer part of the system. But across the state, we've seen decreases because we have have invested in the solutions that we know work, permanent supportive housing, investments in shelter. We've increased investments in shelter by over 800% over the last few years. So we know what works, mm-hmm. and we are very concerned that this shift will erase all of the progress that we have collectively made in ensuring that everyone has a home.
A shift beginning as soon as January, away from policy that gets people into housing, rather than tying housing to work and treatment requirements. We know that there are cuts coming to programs that subsidize rent for folks at high risk of becoming homeless. Your summary, Mark, as we wrap here on what this means for Illinoisans and whether we can hold on to some kind of hope here.
Yeah, so this most recent attack by HUD is sort of a series of attacks over the last year. The attacks on Medicaid, the attacks on housing, the attacks on certain professions, nursing and social work, that will no longer be eligible for federal loans, the very workforce that we need to do the work that we do.
Right.
So really, right now, sort of everything that we're doing to serve the most marginalized people in our country is under attack. But I do remain hopeful. The organizing that we're doing, the mm-hmm. storytelling that we're doing, the lawsuits that are pending.
Yeah.
There's a movement
against
these thresholds
and beyond. You're working to put pressure on the federal government.
Right. We, with our housing and community mental health partners, organized a letter last week that generated hundreds of sign-ons from organizations all over the country. I'm hopeful. 22 Republican Congress people from across the country signed a letter very similar to ours saying that these cuts are draconian and they will hurt our communities. There's been bipartisan support for housing first and permanent supportive housing for decades. So that's why I remain hopeful, because the evidence is on our side.
We'll keep an eye. Mark Ishag is CEO of Thresholds and Christine Haley is Illinois' Chief Homelessness Officer. Thank you both so much.
Thank you, Sash.
Great to be here.
Okay, now let's break down the top local stories of the day. At the table, WBEZ Morning Edition anchor Claire Lane and Mohammed Samra, who's a reporter with the Chicago Sun-Times. Mohammed started us off with an update about the overnight parking ban that went into effect.
There were 227 total cars towed on the first night of the parking ban, which is actually the lowest in 4 years and the second lowest this decade.
Oh, okay. That sounds like a lot to me.
Yeah, still a substantial amount, but I was out at the South Deering Pound at 103rd and Doty Avenue, and impacted drivers were just funneling in and out, most kind of expressing mild frustration, but a lot taking accountability, just saying that they forgot about the ban going into effect. Mm-hmm. A lot had to miss work in the morning, so they were just concerned with getting in there, getting out as quick as possible, and just going about their day.
And just even in chatter here behind the scenes with my team, I feel like there's a lot of confusion about how this ban works. So why don't you remind us, Mohammed?
Yeah, so the ban goes into effect for 107 miles of main streets throughout the city, where drivers can't park on streets between 3 a.m. and 7 a.m. from December 1st to April 1st. And this is done to allow emergency vehicles and public transportation to move freely, and it reduces hazardous conditions for drivers, pedestrians, and other travelers. Drivers who I spoke to were mostly towed from the front of their homes, and they expressed frustrations over a lack of parking options.
Yeah.
And they were worried about running the risk of getting stuck in some of the side streets that aren't immediately cleared from snow.
So even the streets that were clean, which is where a lot of these people were parking, makes sense, right? But their car can still get towed on the clean streets.
Yeah, regardless of whether there's snow or not. And that's mostly done to maintain consistency.
And that's how they get you.
It's a hard to read sign. I mean, it says or. Right? And you think that it's and, but it's actually or, and it's so small. So the snow is, you know, irrelevant. But when your eyes first read it, you're thinking it's dependent on snow.
Right.
Not quite.
That's absolutely what I thought it was, for sure. So good to know. Thank you, Mohammed. So I can see why drivers were, you said mildly frustrated. I think I'd be a heck of a lot frustrated.
Yeah, well, I think the extra snow kind of, you know, gave drivers that little extra room.
In other news, Claire, while Mayor Brandon Johnson tries to get more support for his budget proposal, we got some Chicago City Council members who are kind of coming up with their own plan. So tell us more. Who's involved in this and what exactly do they have in mind?
So this is a small group of City Council members, 9th Ward Alder Matt O'Shea, Nicole Lee of the 11th, Samantha Nugent of the 39th, 32nd Ward Alder Scott Wagisback, 47th Matt Martin, and Finance Chair Pat Dowell of the 3rd Ward. This is all in an effort to avoid Mayor Johnson's proposed corporate head tax, yes, so to speak, and to avoid raising property taxes, which he still says he won't do. But according to the Sun-Times, the revised pitch will hold the line on those property taxes, but aims to increase, this is a $9.50 a month garbage collection fee to roughly $20 a month. But mind you, that collection fee has been frozen since 2015 when it was created, right, at that $9.50 mark.
So they're coming with their own fees.
Yeah, they're coming in with their own fees. The fee proposal would exempt senior citizens. We should make note of that. Okay. But even at the increased rate, Chicago's fee would still recoup just about 55% of the city's actual waste collection costs. So additionally, Mayor Johnson's proposed $21 a month per employee head tax on companies, we know this, with 100 or more employees, which was shot down by the Finance Committee. That would also likely potentially be replaced by, this is Alder Gilbert Viejas's proposal, to charge residents and businesses $1.25 per every package they get delivered.
Oh, that sounds like fun. It sounds like I also have to scale down the number of packages
so
I get.
So much for that Cyber Monday deal,
right,
you got.
Right, exactly. Mohammed, looks like the Real ID is back in the news. Some travelers who are maybe not using it might get in a little something. What's going on?
Yeah, so there will be a $45 fee that goes into effect on February 1st of next year. That's specifically for those traveling domestically without a Real ID. Though there are other acceptable forms of ID that include passports, passport cards, military IDs, permanent resident cards, and photo IDs from federally recognized tribal nations.
Mm-hmm.
TSA officials have said that paying the fee doesn't necessarily guarantee verification, and travelers whose IDs cannot be verified could be turned away. But if approved, the verification covers a 10-day period, and the fee can be paid online before coming to the airport.
Oh.
Though travelers,
so you're paying the fee just so you can get through. If you don't have a Real ID, you're paying the fee so you can be,
correct,
able to advance.
Yeah.
Not because you're being punished for not having a Real ID yet.
No, it's still, you're paying the fee to be able to advance and move forward until
not
you're able
hold
to
up
get
the
there.
Line.
Yeah. Not hold up the line.
Keep, yeah, people happy.
And you could pay the fee at the airport before entering the security line, but it,
right,
would take, that process takes about half an hour, which would add to an already, lengthy TSA.
Folks,
time.
Just get your Real ID.
You're rolling your eyes, Sasha.
I am.
You think it's a cash grab.
I do think it's a cash grab.
At TSA.
Why? What is the point? If you're still going to let them through anyway, but you just took, what is it, $45?
$45.
Like, you just wanted $45.
And mind you, a passport is $130 for a renewal. So if you do the math there, depending on how much you're traveling,
right?
I mean, think a Real ID, something like $35.
Yeah. So, well, I guess technically you're paying this fee to use the TSA ID verification system. And as Mohammed pointed out, I mean, they might not even be able to verify. So that $45 fee, though, non-refundable. So whatever your outcome is, you're not getting that money back. Anyway, for the first time in more than 20 years, Claire, Cook County's got a new chief judge. Tell us about this person.
Yes, this is Charles Beach, took the oath of office yesterday after defeating 8-time incumbent Judge Timothy Evans. Sun-Times reporting he's expected to announce more of a leadership team and what his implementation plan is in the coming weeks. Beach is 55. He was first elected to the bench back in 2017, served as a supervisor in both the traffic and pretrial division, where he helped usher in Illinois' pretrial detention system following the end of cash bail, if you remember that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and tell us more about how he differs from Chief Judge Timothy Evans, that was the 8-time incumbent who he beat.
Right. So what's really at stake is that Beach is taking over this office, which is currently under fire for its management of the county's electronic monitoring system. Criticism mounting again over this just after, you know, last month, remember, a man who was on electronic monitoring, who had repeatedly violated the conditions of his home detention, allegedly set fire to a woman on a CTA Blue Line train. So that woman, as we know, critically wounded, and the man has been charged with terrorism. So this is just a hot ticket issue. State's Attorney Eileen O'Neill Burke is condemning this move, saying that Beach questioning his ability to even safely administer this electronic monitoring system. Beach didn't directly address, you know, what his policy will be on this moving forward. All he said, he left the audience with the message, the work begins now. So keeping it kind of generic, but he has to know that this is something that's raising a lot of, you know, questions.
Right, right. Anything else you're watching right now?
Well, there was controversy, holiday controversy, over the Christ Kindle Market. Attendees were limited just last week. There was lots of complaints from vendors and organizers. Long lines, losing money. Chicago officials have increased the capacity in response to that. So the very popular holiday market new limit is roughly 2,500 people inside at a time.
Yeah.
So that's a big increase from what it initially was last week, but it's still about 1,000 less people than capacity during the COVID-19 pandemic, when we all know social distancing was sort of at its height. So city also is saying they will continue to make adjustments as needed.
Yeah.
They want to give the people what they want, which is holiday cheer.
They want holiday markets, holiday cheer. Mohammed, in other news, we got friends of Armani Floyd who got together last week. This was for a vigil. A reminder for folks who don't remember, Armani Floyd is that 14-year-old boy who was killed in that tragic shooting in the Loop just a little over a week ago. And since then, Mohammed, you've been able to find out just a little bit more about who this boy was. Tell us about Armani.
So Armani Floyd, friends and family all describe him as a funny, outgoing, respectful kid who was very passionate about basketball and giving back to communities around him. Ulysses Floyd Sr., his father, had told me that he was a dedicated volunteer in his nonprofit organization called Organizing Leaders, and hoped that Armani would take ownership of the nonprofit someday.
Mm.
He'd always joined for various giveaways, and he was actually supposed to be present at a turkey giveaway that occurred the Wednesday after he was fatally shot.
Jeez. Yeah, this vigil was at a basketball court. It's super fitting, of course, because he was part of that after-school program, and it uses basketball to prevent gun violence. Like, he was really actively involved in making sure he and his peers were doing the right thing.
Yeah, he
was. Sounds like very tragic way for him to go, and far too soon. It's also renewing a lot of conversation, Mohammed, around how we handle these so-called teen trends or teen takeovers and overall safety when it comes to being downtown. Second Ward Alderman Brian Hopkins is saying that he wants to reintroduce a proposal to create a snap curfew. We remember he tried that before, and Mayor Johnson vetoed it back in the summer. Before the end of the year, he says he wants to try again. How do you think that could shake out?
So Hopkins told the Sun-Times that they were looking to make some revisions to come up with an alternative curfew plan that would have, quote, been a useful tool to potentially have prevented the loss of life.
Yeah.
Previous Sun-Times reporting stated that young teams have been organizing gatherings in the Loop for years because they feel there isn't much to do in neighborhoods. And while these meetups aren't intended to cause violence and don't necessarily promote it, they can go wrong because they don't have structure.
Mm-hmm.
And though I'm unsure what the snap curfew revisions might look like, maybe we see a resolution that involves investing more into community so that teens have more to do closer to home.
Yeah. So much to dig into in this topic, and I'm hoping that we can get to talk more about these teen trends, these teen takeovers, in a future segment on In the Loop. That's WBEZ's Claire Lane and Mohammed Samra from the Sun-Times.
This episode of the In the Loop podcast was produced by me, Linnea Dominic, and edited by Ethan Schwab. Sasha Ann Simons is our host. For more in-depth coverage of news and culture in Chicago, be sure to subscribe to this podcast. For a full archive of the show, head over to wbez.org/in the loop. Thanks for listening.